Match Boy. Overlooking Phoenix. From high above in the Star Worldwide Network studios. Badge Boys. Stories, insight, guests, and true blue humor with retired police sergeant Darren Birch and retired police officer Jason Schechterly. And now, here they are, the Badge Boys.
Welcome back to another edition of Badge Boys, the show where normally two cops talk to a community, but today I'm riding solo. And I'm retired Silent Witness Sergeant Darren Birch.
And I'm Rockin' Robin. You can't forget, we're not exactly solo, but Jason is well missed.
Yeah, the boys. As far as it comes to boys, I'm by myself. Because I am in a room with two beautiful ladies. I got, of course, Rockin' Robin, as always, and I have Yvette Johnson. She wrote a book that is called The Song and the Silence. And it's a book that I read straight through, cover to cover. It's amazing. It's about a young woman's journey to understand her roots, her grandfather, who was murdered. And it's a riveting, riveting account of this young lady going to the Delta, a world that she was so unfamiliar with. So I look forward to that interview, which will be after this break. And then after that, we'll be talking with Sean Reavy. Sean Reavy is a child crimes detective. He also connects with children and superheroes. He brings superheroes to these kids, allows them this beautiful story of empowerment. It's just, I can't wait to talk to him as well. And then the last segment I'll be doing without Jason, but I'll be bringing you the Stupid Suspect stories, a heroic headline, and we will, in his honor, not do the inspirational moment and close. So stay tuned, stay informed, and most of all, you'll be entertained.
More stories, inside guests, and true blue humor coming up on Badge Boys. We'll be back right after this.
I remember the moment.
I'll never forget that moment.
As long as I live.
As long as I live.
Several of us were working to rescue a family.
The house collapsed on top of the cellar door and trapped them.
We had to use Humvees and heavy machinery to move massive trees and debris.
We got them out.
We helped a lot of people out.
It felt good to know I could really make a difference.
Because I'm a citizen soldier in the National Guard.
Be there the moment your community needs you. Learn more at NationalGuard.com.
Sponsored by the Arizona National Guard. Aired by the Arizona Broadcasters Association and this station.
Move over, AZ. Arizona's move over law requires you to move over or slow down when you drive past any vehicle pulled over with flashing lights. Remember, every vehicle, every time. Move over, AZ.
Sponsored by ADOT in partnership with the Arizona Broadcasters Association and this station.
You're listening to Badge Boys with retired police sergeant Darren Birch and retired police officer Jason Schechterly. Now, back to the Badge Boys.
Welcome back, and I really do have an incredible guest to talk to. She wrote this book, and when I say book, it's amazing. It, in a way, kind of reminded me of To Kill a Mockingbird, but different. But it's the same kind of time period. It's the, you know, the Delta. It's understanding race issues. And the one thing I love about this guest, she talks about diversity without division. And so without further ado, I want to introduce you, Yvette Johnson. Yvette, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Now,
Please. Before we get too far, you know, I'm a creative person. I have lots of ideas. I bring lots of ideas to the table. And I was thinking about your intro, and, you know, I really love the theme song to that movie, Bad Boys, you know, like, or was that the theme song to Cops? You know, Badge Boys, Badge Boys. What you gonna do? Anyhow, that's my idea. I'm sure it
started
a whole bunch of money.
I actually started singing that my first week I got this show. Everybody was looking at me like I was a weirdo.
I'm right there with you. I guess we're fellow geniuses. What are we gonna do?
And if there wasn't copyright infringements, it would happen. You know it. You know it.
All right.
Absolutely.
So that's it.
I met you through LinkedIn, five years ago.
Yeah, it was definitely LinkedIn. Yeah.
LinkedIn.
Yeah.
And I instantly fell in love with what you're talking about in terms of diversity. We're all different. We all have things to bring to the table, especially from a military background and a police background. We want those skill sets. We want that diversity.
Of course.
It's teamwork.
It makes you better at your job.
Now, if you would, I want to start off the show with talking a little bit about what you do as far as your lectures, what you do in that regards, and then we'll segue into the book.
Well, I'm basically a person with ADHD who has way too many jobs. And so I'm either unemployed or busy as, you know, who knows what. But my primary job is I homeschool the most handsome boys on the planet. my two boys. And but aside from that, I'm a writer, a documentary filmmaker. I do workshops about undoing, decoding unconscious bias. And I give talks about race, bias, my book, The Song of the Silence. So I still sometimes get invited to do book signings. I just got back from a trip to Kentucky and Mississippi where I did a race symposium. So we had talks with communities that themselves had sort of been ground zero, you know, for lack of a better phrase, during the civil rights movement. So communities that really are still just feeling the trauma of what happened so long ago and what continues to happen. And so I was there representing, you know, my voice. And it's interesting because I'm an outsider and I had a co-host who was also sort of an outsider. But she made a documentary film about Mississippi because she grew up there during the civil rights movement. And then she got married and moved to Canada and has lived in Canada her whole life. Well, people would say to her sometimes, why do you have these wonderful memories of Mississippi? What we see in the media is this horrible place. So she made a documentary to return to Mississippi to defend her state, and her eyes were opened about how much she had failed to see and how much racism and hate there really was there that was happening in her own neighborhood that she just didn't experience. And my documentary film, Booker's Place, A Mississippi Story, I returned to Mississippi having left when I was 2 years old. You know, my parents moved us away. Wasn't on my own. I wasn't packing my suitcase. But my film was really trying to understand how people could be so horrible and monstrous. And I came to find beautiful people who I had a lot more in common with than I thought, who were just very conflicted.
In starting this journey, let's start with you as a child living in a affluent environment. Your father was a NFL football player, not just NFL football player. He was a standout. He was very good.
He's done some things. It's on Wikipedia. I always try and describe it, but I get the details confused. I really don't know how to play football. I went to all of his home games as a kid, but it was just boring. I thought, why is daddy wearing those tight pants? You know, I was too young to really get it.
Treat him like he's a god.
People wanted his autograph. I used to sell his autograph actually at school when I was a kid. So,
dude, that's smart.
Is that right? Right? I told you she was smart.
Entrepreneurial spirit right there.
That's right. Born with it.
So tell me about that transition from that type of lifestyle. I'll call it the Beverly Hills 90210 lifestyle with, you know, a famous father and then going to the Delta. Can you tell me about how that came about?
Yeah. Well, still, yeah. I mean, I grew up in an all-white neighborhood. My parents, you know, luxury cars, Mercedes-Benz, Cadillacs, everything's gorgeous. My mom, I think, felt like she finally made it when we had a white maid. and she was the whole picture. She was blonde, you know, blue eyes. I was like, wow, it's like something out of a movie. Sometimes I describe it as I look back on those years and I feel like I kind of had battered woman syndrome, you know, where a woman's husband might, or, you know, her loved one might beat her up. And she knows that she's in danger, but she feels like she doesn't have a way to escape. So when he comes back and with flowers and says, I'll never do it again,
the cycle begins.
She lets herself believe it. And I was sort of growing up in the shadow of the civil rights movement. So it was a time in history when people said, okay, it was wrong, but it's over. So if you said, oh, you know, I feel as though I may have been discriminated against, or is it possible that that shooting or that, you know, political decision had to do with race? People would say to you, if you were black, that you're playing the race card, that you have a chip on your shoulder. And so first you're sort of, you experience this trauma by being on the receiving end of racism, but then sort of the second trauma of not being believed. So I, you know, being young, didn't really know how to deal with that. And so I just sort of told myself, well, it is my fault. And there are no race issues in this nation. If I feel something, it's my fault. So I'm just going to sort of ignore it. Because I felt powerless to change it.
Or you're imagining it.
Yeah, exactly. It's in my head. Or maybe I was, you know, acting ghetto, even though I don't even know how to do that. Because, you know, where I grew up, you know. I always tell people, I'm like, I feel so uncomfortable sometimes in a room full of African Americans. Because I don't know if P. Diddy's like a producer or, you know.
You don't know the lingo.
I know. I never know who's who. I'm just like, I don't know. I listen to Pearl Jam. So anyhow. But, you know, then I had these two amazing little boys who I wanted them to see themselves the way that I saw them. And, you know, I was paying attention to the news and sort of understanding the incarceration rates of black males. And I thought, you know, I got to understand more about not just the history of African Americans in our country, but also my own family. Because my family also, there were certain pockets of my family that were also representative of some of those unsavory statistics about the African American community. And so I am a researcher, so I started doing two tracks of research. One was to really be able to understand the story of blacks in our nation so that I could give that story to my sons in a way that would make them feel not shackled, but make them feel like overcomers. And I also wanted to understand more about my family so that if there was something I wasn't seeing because it was ingrained in me, you know, they say that, you know, you dance the dance, you know, so oftentimes people repeat patterns of abuse or things like that. So I thought, you know, I really want to make sure that I understand how my family got off track. And I discovered this story about my grandfather that I didn't know about, no one in my family knew about. And I wanted to know more about him and who he was.
And so what was that initial story?
We took a trip to the Delta. Well, what I learned was that he appeared in a one-hour documentary on NBC, kind of like what a Dateline or a 48 sure. Hours is now, but not necessarily a crime focus. It was really a filmmaker went to Mississippi to try to actually get the white perspective on why they were opposed to integration. So the film was made in 65, aired wow. in 66. And my grandfather, he was only on for about 2.5 minutes, his little piece in this one-hour film. But newspapers all over the country carried stories about this episode, and almost all of them mentioned my grandfather. And he just talked really eloquently about what it felt like to be on the receiving end of racism, what it felt like to live in a world where no matter how hard you tried or how professional you were, you still couldn't really guarantee safety for yourself or a future for your children. And it broke my heart learning that story about him, but it also really motivated me to uncover as much as I could about him. And I never met him. He died the year before I was born.
So. And he didn't just die.
Yeah, he was murdered.
And it was an unsolved case.
Well, it wasn't.
Yes or no, right?
I mean, it's one of those things. There is someone in jail for the murder, but there were a lot of questions about surrounding his murder.
So, gotcha.
Yeah.
So you take this journey. Tell us about that.
Well, I wanted to sort of give myself a crash course in the time and place that he lived in, that his life occurred, that the events surrounding his death occurred. And it was probably, you know, I didn't really have much of a choice, but it was, in a way, it was the best way to do it and sort of the worst way to do it. I went down with a film crew, and so I was, you know, there were deadlines. I couldn't just sort of process it the way that I would have wanted to process it.
You had a working hat on, too.
Slowly, exactly, as I was co-producing. We had a lot going on. So, I just was faced with the horrors of police violence and lynchings and really horrible things in about 6 weeks of time, just reading, talking to people, doing interviews over the phone. And so when I went to Mississippi, I almost felt like I was walking onto like the death row of a prison, like the worst of the worst of
sure.
humanity.
Because that's what you've been hearing for.
Exactly. That had really been what I've been paying attention to. And I just met people who were trying to figure out how to raise their own families in a very broken system. And I definitely believe there were some monsters, but I think there were also a lot of people who aren't dissimilar from the average person today, who just feels overwhelmed with their own life and doesn't feel like they can, you know, save the whales or help the trans people or fix the environment. And I think for a lot of sort of day-to-day Southerners, that was the sense that, yeah, this isn't right, and yeah, I should do something, but, you know, I got to go pick up my kids, or I got to, you know, they weren't all monsters as much as I had sort of believed they would be.
Gotcha. Tell us about your grandfather.
Well, my grandfather's
as you smile,
name was
big
Booker
smile.
Wright. Yeah. His name was Booker Wright, and he was actually, he was orphaned when he was 14, and even before that, the people who raised him really treated him as though he was a moneymaker. He could work and bring in income. And so at 14, he got a job working in what was actually the most exclusive restaurant in on the white side of town. So actually, a lot of whites who I interviewed when I went to Mississippi had never even been to the restaurant until they were adults because they couldn't afford to go. So it was really just the cream of the crop of that town. And it was itself a very influential town. Lots of money went through that city. So he was illiterate because he wasn't allowed to go to school as a kid. He had to work instead. And the restaurant actually didn't even have printed menus because so many of their all-black wait staff was illiterate. So my grandfather began to sing the menu.
I'm smiling when you say that, but because I know where this is going. Yeah. I love the way he memorized the menu.
Yeah, it's this great, great rhyming song. And it's on YouTube. It's like, you know, it's a two-minute clip. And if you can Google Booker Wright on YouTube if you want to hear it. But he would sing the menu. So the filmmaker, whose name was Frank DiFelita, who was making this one-hour doc for documentary for Dateline, was in Mississippi. And people said, you got to go hear Booker Wright sing the menu down at Lesko's in Greenwood. So he said, okay, I'll go. I'll get some steaks. And my grandfather sang the menu, and Frank thought, oh, I could use this as a transition in my film. I'd like to record him. Well, my grandfather also owned his own restaurant on the black side of town. And it's interesting because, you know, Lesko's was the place to go if you were white, but his was the place to go if you were black, you know.
What a interesting duality.
Yeah, he learned a lot working at Lesko's and really used that in his own place.
As an entrepreneur.
Exactly, yeah. He was very thoughtful, and he wanted his customers to have a great experience because he knew that most of them were living lives where they experienced discrimination. So he wanted them to feel like kings and queens when they walked into his place.
Approximately, what year is this?
So he was filmed in 65. Okay. He opened his restaurant in the late 50s.
Okay.
So, yeah, so he, so Frank, the filmmaker, said, you know, I'd love to film you doing this. And Booker said, well, you know, basically the owner actually said, well, you can't do that here. And so Booker said, I've got my own restaurant.
Come
so they, yeah, they met a few nights later at Booker's place. They shut it down so Frank could do this interview. And my grandfather sang the menu, and he really is kind of like those old minstrel shows where just that idea, that stereotype of the dim-witted, happy slave, you know, like just, oh, da-da-da-da-da. And that's kind of how he sings the menu with this big, huge smile. And while the camera was still rolling, he looked into the camera and he changed and became a man and said, that's how I talk because that's how my customers want me to talk. Wow. And then he just went on to just explain what it's like to have to pretend that you're stupid, to have to let people call you the N-word. And so the film aired a year later, actually a little bit under a year later, but, you know, it took some time post-production. And Frank actually was really afraid for my grandfather's safety.
Wow.
And he contacted him and said, you know, maybe we shouldn't run this. And my grandfather's like, nope, leave it in. I knew what I was doing. So it aired, and the night that it aired, my grandfather was actually working at Lesko's, and they had a TV in the lounge. And so people were watching it, and they began saying, we don't want him to serve us. We don't want to have him work here anymore. People began calling in, saying we never want to work with him again. So he worked at Lesko's at that point 25 years. And he left and never went back. They sent him home. And the night after it aired, he was pistol whipped by a white police officer.
Wow.
So,
wow.
Yeah.
Such a sad story.
Yeah. It's a sad story. But, you know, I feel like he was someone who, in the worst of circumstances, you know, lived a great life.
And talk a little bit, if you will, about his murder.
Yeah. So here's what's interesting. You know, he was, in so many ways, the Jim Crow South, there were these different layers of oppression. And my grandfather, he was really friendly with lots of powerful whites. So they believed, well, Booker seems happy, he seems fine, and he's my black friend. Now, the truth of it is that, you know, just as when he spoke up, he was pistol whipped, you know, the very next night he was attacked, there was always this threat of violence.
Sure.
So, yes, there were blacks who looked happy, but it was because they knew if they didn't that someone could harm them. And they really, there was no safe place for them. You know, there are many stories of whites committing murder and not even being tried. The whole town knows who did it. And that's just the way that it was back then. So you really just didn't feel safe and you couldn't defend anyone. So a lot of the blacks saw my grandfather going to the white side of town, commiserating with these powerful people in the community. And on the black side of town, he had this great place. And
business owner.
And so a lot of people just thought he's got it made and didn't really see
his hardship,
the cloak of shame, exactly, that he had to put on in order to, you know, so he basically is in this, the chapter in the book is called The Place Where He Was King. You know, he's in Booker's place where he is the king, and a word from him, everyone just gets in line, and then he has to become the subservient, sort of humble individual to go to work at Lesko's. There were actually a lot of poor blacks who didn't like him. Regardless of the things that he did to help the community, there were some who really didn't like him.
Envious.
Exactly, yeah. And so, and it was known that he did not sort of let, the phrase my dad used was riffraff come into the restaurant. And people just knew that. And so there was a kid who everyone knew, and he came in one night begging other people at Booker's Place. He went into the restaurant begging people to give him food, which, again, people just, you knew that my grandfather would throw you out if you did
right,
that.
Right, right. That so was my, against the rules.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it was just the known thing. So my grandfather kicked him out, and he came back and shot him through a window with a sawed-off shotgun. But there were just other issues. So there was a particular officer who actually still lives in the community out there who really hated my grandfather, the one who we're pretty sure pistol-whipped him, he just continued over the years to do things to humiliate my grandfather. He'd walk into the restaurant, walk into the kitchen, stick his hand into a pot of cooking food and eat it, just sort of to communicate to them.
Intimidating.
I can treat you however you want, and you have no one to call. You have no recourse. You are under my thumb. And his partner actually shot Silas McGee, a famous civil rights activist, in the face. And so, and these two sort of had a reputation of just being, you know, they weren't anything like you, Darren. I'll say that. They, you know, they did not wear the badge with honor. And honestly, it's tricky, I think, the relationship between, you know, blacks and police officers, because especially in the South, for so many years, segregation was the law, and police had to enforce the law. So they sort of, in a way, were on the side of segregationists,
right,
you know.
Right.
The way that Blackie, the person who actually committed the murder, the way that he was arrested, the things that him even having access to that shotgun, he was very well known by these two police officers. And during his trial, many people just thought his demeanor was the demeanor of someone who thought he would get off.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
And his family sort of believes that he didn't do it. So, you know, it was a pathway that I was going down for a while, but it was also sort of making me nuts. I ended up finding the police there worked with me and showed me the photos that were taken of him at the hospital, you know, riddled with bullets and, you know, just tubes coming out of him. And it's actually sometimes when people who were, he had later in life, he had sort of a larger belly. And sometimes if you have a large abdominal wound and they sew you up and you've got this extra fat and you've got this swelling, sometimes it opens. And so I saw that image of him, and I still remember, you know, blogging about it and people, you know, from around the country reading my blog saying, stop, 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 you know, like, this is not for you to do. Let someone else take up this
yeah.
question. So
now, in the minute that we have left, transition to the way you were treated by the police officers now in 2000?
Yeah. Well, that's a tricky question. I mean, me personally, or...
Or as so, far as your attempt, I mean, to make this film.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I think a lot about police officers. And did you say I have a minute left?
Yeah,
so,
I know.
All right, well, you're going to have to...
We go over
you're
a
gonna
minute.
You're going to have to
we
work
can go
that
over
out.
A minute.
So, no, I mean, I... you know, so really quickly, I'll say that I ended up developing some workshops on unconscious bias. And in part, I was just curious about cops. I began doing it during the time when people were really beginning sort of nationwide to pass these cell phone videos of officers, you know, either making mistakes or doing things that were questionable or outright illegal. And I have kids who are chocolatey. My oldest son now, he's 6'3" with anxiety. And I'm just always like, buddy, no one's going to be afraid of you. You know, like you're going to be safe. You're the tallest one. But so I learned, I mean, I really developed really just an empathy for officers. I met officers who won't tell people what they do for a living because they're afraid for their family's safety.
In today's environment.
Yeah. And we talked about like how these officers, you know, will walk into a room and people will just believe that they are, you know, people who went into the profession because they want to kill, or they'll assume that these officers are racist when they're not. And I was actually in a conversation once with an officer who was describing how, you know, trying to do community policing, building relationships, and he was driving down a street slowly in Tempe, and he saw these people out front, like just sort of out in front of their house hanging out, and he just waved and said hello, and they threw drinks at him, called him a racist, and while he's talking to me, he got choked up and just walked away.
Wow.
Yeah, and I thought, you know, I don't think that I could have a job where you're so misunderstood, you're so vilified, you know, a few bad actors paint the entire thing. But then I went to Flagstaff, and so it's trend. They're getting death threats from people all over the country because of this video, you know, that's on national news. And but actually, I mean, I have done this work and given these talks to all types of groups, and I will say, like, the most teachable group I've ever worked with was Flagstaff PD.
I love it.
I framed unconscious bias not as, you know, something wrong with you, but something wrong with all of us, and you know what? It might even make you a better cop. They were so, like, disarmed. They were like, oh, you can help me be a better cop? And they just soaked it up.
I love it.
But it's unfortunate because one bad incident really can impact an entire community or a generation.
And that's why I love talking about diversity without division. I love it. I cannot thank you enough for being on our show today.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
And we'll be right back.
More stories, inside guests, and true blue humor coming up on Batch Boys. We'll be back right after this.
Move over, AZ. Arizona's move over law requires you to move over or slow down when you drive past any vehicle pulled over with flashing lights. Remember, every vehicle, every time. Move over, AZ.
Sponsored by ADOT in partnership with the Arizona Broadcasters Association and this station.
I remember the moment. I'll never forget that moment.
As long as I live.
As long as I live.
Several of us were working to rescue a family.
The house collapsed on top of the cellar door and trapped them.
We had to use Humvees and heavy machinery to move massive trees and debris.
We got them out.
We helped a lot of people out.
It felt good to know I could really make a difference.
Because I'm a citizen soldier in the National Guard.
Be there the moment your community needs you. Learn more at NationalGuard.com.
Sponsored by the Arizona National Guard. Aired by the Arizona Broadcasters Association and this station.
You're listening to Batch Boys with retired police sergeant Darren Birch and retired police officer Jason Schechterly. Now, back to the Batch Boys.
And again, I am without my Batch Boy buddy, Jason. So what we have here is a buddy of mine, Sean Ravey. He is with the Phoenix Police Department Child Crimes Unit. And more importantly, or actually as important, he does something to help the children. It has a superheroes theme to it that I just absolutely love. And having worked in child crimes myself as a detective and then as a supervisor, I can't give you enough kudos, Sean. How long have you been in that unit?
Next month, it'll be 6 years.
That's amazing because, as you know, preaching to the choir, that's a difficult unit to work.
It's dark.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of sadness there. And so what I'm trying to do is bring a little light not only to the children we see, but it'll help me. It's cathartic for me as well.
You know, it's funny you mentioned that because I was going to talk to you about that. As difficult and daunting as the investigations are dealing with all these sad crimes, because you're not just dealing with the sex crimes, which is horrific enough. You're dealing with the neglect. You're dealing with the physical abuse. You're dealing with all of it against children. But I can't help but think that you putting on these events, and we'll talk about that, with superheroes and fun and seeing all the laughter, that it's got to be therapeutic for you to allow you to continue your job because you're putting happiness back into the sad tank. Can you talk about that?
Oh, absolutely. Well, in 2015, I had been in the unit for 2 years. I'd probably investigated 300-400 cases. And it dawned on me rather quickly that I had these little kids for a very short time. And they were coming in confused, sad, afraid. And they were leaving confused, sad, and afraid. And I had an epiphany when I was interviewing a little boy that wasn't opening up to me. And I had no evidence other than what his statement would have been. There's no bio evidence. There's no witnesses, no video. And he just wasn't able to talk to me. So as a last-ditch effort, being a nerd as I am, I just asked him if he liked superheroes. Totally different kid. He sat up straight. We talked for 20 minutes about Iron Man and Spider-Man and the new Avengers movie had just come out, and he told me everything that happened to him after that because we connected. And I walked out.
He felt safe.
Yeah, he did. And because the problem also that people don't realize, I'm an adult interviewing a child who's been hurt by an adult.
Adult, absolutely.
And it's kind of hard for them to separate the two unless you really try hard to separate yourself from that. And we connected on that level of being
two geeks.
Two geeks. Being both excited about the new movie. Ant-Man had just come out. And then I walked out into the lobby of the Child Help Center and realized, you know, what a difference it might make if we put superhero posters and comic books in the lobby when these kids came in.
A very kind of modest effort, if you will, just put something to make them feel a little comfortable, but it's grown exponentially.
It really did. It went from comic books and posters to me thinking, well, how cool would it be to, as they leave, give them their favorite superhero action figure and t-shirt. And we decided to hold an event that September called Superhero September. We had retired police officers and firefighters dress up like superheroes, nothing fancy. Had the Batmobile from the Colton Cowell Foundation, and it turned into something way bigger than we anticipated. And we took a lot of items into the center that year, and it went from there. And this year is the fifth annual Superhero September. We've raised so much money and in-kind donations that the center couldn't hold it anymore.
And talk a little bit about the center, Child Help, the beneficiary of what you're doing, if you will.
What I do is, or what it is, it's a center where a family can bring their child who has been recently victimized. And within that center, we have Phoenix Children's Hospital. We have the Maricopa County Attorney's Office as an attorney there for us to talk about charging issues. We have victims' advocates that meet with the parents to give them proper guidance. We have mental health specialists. If a child is in dire need, they will talk to a mental health therapist, and we have 45 detectives from my unit, the Department of Child Safety, and Office of Child Welfare Investigators, all in the same building.
Yeah, that multidisciplinary approach where the child goes to one location and we go to them.
Yes.
And how important is that?
Well, it's big because it also allows the child to only be interviewed once and not retell the horrible abuse that's happened to them. The doctors will watch it on closed circuit with the Department of Child Safety, the detective, the mental health therapist, the sergeants, the attorney. That way we're all hearing it and seeing it at the same time, and it's memorialized on a CD. And if the child needs services, they get it there. They get fed, they get clean clothes, and things of that nature. And the parents get some peace of mind knowing that they don't have to go all over the city to get this done, because this is the worst day of their lives. I mean, they have no idea. I mean,
they can't even fathom it, really.
They can, and nor can most. And a lot of people don't know or don't want to know about what goes on there. They just don't want to hear it. So what I decided to do was marry that horrible abuse with a topic people do like to go see and do, and that is to put the superheroes with them. And that's changed things.
And let's talk about that now. The superheroes, the event, you have something else new coming up?
I have a lot of new things coming up. At the end of last year, we had taken in enough money and items that the Child Help Center just said we didn't have no place to store this anymore, and which is a good problem.
That's a great problem.
because the first couple of years, all we were able to do were action figures and T-shirts, and it made no sense to me to give an action figure to a child who hadn't eaten and had holes in their shoes. So what I wanted to do was raise enough to give them new shoes, new pants, diapers for their brother or sister, food, and things of that nature. So I really started to expand my efforts, and I decided to incorporate my superhero programs into a charitable foundation. I was taken on pro bono by a law firm downtown. We created a new name called Put on the Cape, a Foundation for Hope. It's a 501c3. I've got a logo and trademarks, and now I'm able to do events all over the state. And I've also have two events in Michigan coming up on September 7th,
wow,
which is my hometown.
Yeah. Oh, good for
it's
you.
It's my home state, so that was a goal of mine. May 18th. Coming up here real quick is our first
next week.
It's next weekend. It's our first superhero 5K in Steele Indian School Park. We have 30 superheroes who are going to be all over the race route. We have 300 runners signed up already. We'll have vendors, live music. It's going to be a blast. And all proceeds from that event are going to go to the Child Advocacy Centers. And I want to raise money for all the advocacy centers in Arizona, not just the one in Central Phoenix. Because there's the centers, what people don't realize is centers don't have a budget for food and toys and clean clothing. That's all at the will of the people to give them. So I want to remove that burden. And I want to do enough things, raise enough notoriety and interest for people to want to give to my foundation, and I in turn can give it to all the advocacy centers in the state.
And, we've known each other for a while. We didn't work together in child crimes.
No, we didn't.
But I had you on my radio show one time, and we were talking about this, and I was just falling in love. And one of the things that you really hit home with me, because I just wanted to talk, oh, my God, Sean, you're amazing. You're this. And you're like, no, it takes a village. Tell me about the people that have helped you along this way.
I couldn't do what I do without synergy and people helping me. I'm just a guy from Michigan. I'm a nerd.
You're a geek from Michigan.
I'm a geek from Michigan. I had an idea that other people said, you know what, that sounds really cool. How can we help you? And that's how you build anything. You need people to support, and not more
your
importantly,
vision.
Believe in the vision and the message. And without people like Gus Matos, who started a Heroes group
United.
Called Heroes United Arizona, when I incorporated, I rolled Heroes United into my Foundation, and Gus is the vice president of my board of directors and in charge of all events. Danielle Gilmore, who formerly worked at Child Help, has moved on. I retained her as my treasurer and secretary for my foundation. So the team is still intact, all the way up my chain of command. My lieutenant, my sergeant, my commander, the assistant chiefs are like, go do what you do.
Total and blessing, carte blanche.
It's a wonderful thing. In fact, the community has resonated so much with it. I got a call yesterday from a doctor's office in Scottsdale. It's like, we'd love to sponsor your 5K if you'll take us. And, well, absolutely, I'll take you. So it's to the point people are contacting us, and we're actually having to turn down events. We're having to say, sorry, we're full. We don't have any openings, which, again, is a good problem to have. And we're growing, and with that are going to be growing pains, of course. We're sure. Only in our third month as a foundation. We've taken in a lot of funds already. Superhero September is going to be the 5th anniversary. It's going to be huge. We have our first charity golf outing on September 28th at the Legacy. And it's turned into what I envisioned in 2015.
It was a dream, wasn't it?
It was. It's something I wanted to do. Because you know the great line I always quote from Spider-Man, with great power comes great responsibility. And when you earn that badge, you have a lot of power. But the responsibility can't stop from your day-to-day of being a police officer. You've got the power to impact a community when you do what you do. It gives a little credibility to what you do. And thankfully, people believed in me. And I just want to continue to make an effort to make people not only talk about child abuse, but come to our events. Because they come to the events and they don't know what we support. And once we tell them, their knees buckle. They have no idea at the magnitude. We had 8,500 kids through the Child Help Center last year, all victims
that
of abuse.
That many sad children.
And that's one center.
Thank you.
One. And so you see the crisis afoot with here. We have 5 kids a day die in the United States from child abuse. And people don't want to talk about that. But horrible topic. It's what nightmares are made of, the things that we see and do. And to come to an event and see professional costumed actors, your niece being one, you know, they're movie quality costumes, and they live the
class
part. And you know, they're not for adults, because when an adult sees Santa Claus, they see a fat guy in a fake beard and a red coat. a child sees Santa Claus.
Yeah.
So when a child sees my Batman, who's 6'4", 220 pounds, in the bat suit, they see Batman. They see Superman, and they actually believe they're talking to and seeing, and they ask for autographs. And it's just absolutely insane how this thing has grown. And we were lucky enough to be at the Special Olympics last weekend. We were invited just out of the blue by the organizer, had heard about us, and we brought 25 superheroes to the opening ceremonies last weekend. It was phenomenal.
And I love the idea that not only is it a great, I don't want to say hook or carrot, but, you know, these great, fun superheroes, but there's a commonality. You know, and you talk a lot about that, because you definitely know what you're talking about when it comes to comic books. You know, the story, the background behind Bruce Wayne and his sadness. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, superheroes rise up from tragedy. Peter Parker witnessed his uncle being killed. He was bullied relentlessly. He was a twerpy little teenage kid with acne. He was picked on constantly. When he got great power, he became Spider-Man and decided to use that power for good. Batman witnessed his parents die. And he used all of his efforts, money, and skills to become Batman. And that's what we want to show these little kids, that there's an inner hero inside of them. And that's why I named the foundation Put on the Cape. Because once you put a cape on a little kid, it could be a bed sheet, and they think it's a superhero cape, and they'll act accordingly. I've seen it. You've seen it. I mean, it's just insane how these little kids suddenly become a hero. When you give them the action figure, you put on the shirt, you put on the mask and the cape, it just totally transforms them from that sad, broken little kid into a hero. And that's what we want to do. And if we can just change one life, that's a generation we've spared. Because it is generational, sadly. And we have to break that cycle somehow. And this is the way I've decided to do it. And with the help of our community and our sponsors and my board and the people who have just said, what can I do for you? Like you. You know, come on my show and talk about what you do. I can't exist without that. And I just appreciate the support from everybody.
I love the empowerment you give these children with the fun, the smile you give them. And you talk a lot about this, and I love what you talk about, the smile, that kids should be smiling and happy. And can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, a child should be jumping up and down in mud puddles, you know, putting frogs in purses, throwing their parents' cell phone in the toilet. They should be a kid. What they shouldn't be is, when they hear the garage door up, is run in their closet and lock it. When they're in bed at night, when they hear footsteps, they shouldn't be huddling under the blankets and shaking. But it happens. It happens all the time. You know, you were there at Child Help. You saw exactly what cases that came in. it's a terrible thing. So what we want to do is in their moment of sadness, because honestly, we have them for this much time, and I know it's radio, but I'm holding up my fingers in an inch. Very small amount of time. And I wasn't impacting that child. Sure, we were arresting the bad guys. We're
taking care of the judicial process of it.
Judicial
not
process.
The advocacy process.
Yes, the cold, this, here, here's your victim's advocate. I get the story. I go, you know, Fade picks up the bad guy. We interrogate. We book. They're done.
Prosecute.
But what have I done for this child while they were with me? Nothing. So what? This small window when I ask them, and now I've taken pictures with all my superheroes because we have over 120 superheroes now in Heroes United. So when I'm having trouble talking to a child and I find out they like Spider-Man, I'm like, if I show you a picture of Spider-Man and me, what would you think? You don't know Spider-Man. So I'll show them a picture of one of my cosplayers in Spider-Man, and we're best friends. They absolutely believe I know Spider-Man, and now they're talking to me.
And there's nothing more timely with the success of the Marvel movies. It really is the perfect marriage, isn't it?
It really is. And to see a child change instantly, that they're looking at their feet, they're hiding behind their mom, and we give them an Iron Man action figure, they scream, Iron Man! And they'll take it out of the box and run around the building with it. I mean, it changes them instantly. And simplicity is always the best answer.
Keep it simple, stupid.
Adults don't do that. Children do.
Yeah.
You could give a child a box, and it's not a box. It's the Game of Thrones castle. And they play in it, and they see themselves as a knight, and you put a bedsheet around their neck, they see themselves as Superman. And that's the simplicity of what we do. And it works. It absolutely works.
I found it worked when I was in The Silent Witness. And as a director, I was looking at trying to grow our, our voice out there. You know, it's all about, you know, maybe Silent Witness, but it's that Silent Witness voice helping solve crimes for the community. And I found that Comic-Con was the perfect conduit for that voice because they're want to be crime fighters.
Exactly.
It's all about solving crimes.
It is. And, you know, I like to use the parable also of the little boy on the beach with the starfish. I'm sure everybody's heard that brief story. Storm washes up millions of starfish. Someone sees a little kid tossing the fish back into the ocean. And they ask him what he's doing, and he said, I'm saving these starfish. And he goes, look at all these starfish. You'll never make a difference. And he picked another one up, threw it in the ocean, looked at the guy, and said, I made a difference for that one.
That's it.
When the kids come into the advocacy center, can I solve all the problems in the country? No, but I can solve that, and I can help that child. And that's the way you have to address it, or quite honestly, you'll lose your mind.
It's overwhelming.
You can't do it.
Yeah, you don't look at a marathon and think, you know, the 10,000 steps. You think about that first step.
Right. And the event we're doing in Michigan in September is for Sparrow Hospital, which is the Phoenix Children's Hospital of Michigan. And they heard about what we're doing, and I reached out to a Michigan cosplay group, and they're all in. I mean, they're all in to expand over into Michigan.
For those people listening that are thinking, I want to be all in, how do they get a hold of you?
www.putonthecape.com. It's our website. You can see our schedule of events. Putonthecape52@gmail.com is our email address. We're looking for sponsors. We're looking for people who just want to do in-kind donations of new in-the-box superhero action figures and Barbies and T-shirts with still the tags on them because that's how the advocacy centers need to take them. And if you just want to donate, there's a donate it a button that goes right to our PayPal account. You can make a difference. $5 will get a child an action figure. You know, and signing up for the 5K, it's $35. That will get an action figure, a shirt, pair of pants, shoes, and some food for one child who comes to see us. And that's when you know you've done something. Because this isn't just going up to the sky. We hit our board of directors is all voluntary. Heroes United is all voluntary. We take no money. All the money goes to the kids, as it should. And we're asking people to put on the cape and be a hero to a child who deserves one, because they do.
If there is one point in this journey early on where you had that aha moment of, oh my gosh, this isn't just working, this is beautiful, can you share that one moment, if there was one?
There wasn't. I'm getting chills just thinking about it.
I knew there would be.
I know. This was so powerful because the first year we didn't know what we were doing. Obviously, we're just throwing things. We had 3 weeks to plan it. We had no idea what it was going to be. And I was wondering toward the end of September, did I make a difference? And a child came in from another jurisdiction. She was 7 years old. She had just been sexually assaulted by her uncle. She hid under a chair in the lobby when her mom tried to get her, because there's a playroom at Child Help where the kids go to play and relax a little bit.
Big tree.
She wrapped herself around her mom's leg, and her mom literally had to drag her to get her into the playroom. When she got in there, she ran and hid behind a beanbag chair. There were other kids playing in there. So I went in, and I asked one of the playroom attendants if we had any capes left, because people donated capes and cowls. And she said, I think we have one. and it was a pink Barbie cape with a little pink Barbie mask. And we put that on this little girl who was
literally hiding.
She was hiding. She had her arms wrapped around her knees were to her chest. Put it around her neck and put the mask on her. Within a second, she jumped up, raised her hands in the air, said, "I'm a superhero," ran towards the other kids and said, "I'm going to save all of you." It changed that child instantly. And again, as adults, when we hear hoofbeats, we think of horses. When kids hear hoofbeats, they think of zebras. They think differently than we do. They always wanted to go to the unicorn and the superhero and the princess and the saving somebody from danger. And that's what that did for that little girl. So I said, aha.
It is working.
It works. And so
firsthand.
Yeah. And I've been approached by therapists who are in tears saying, these kids just, they don't open up until they see a superhero action figure on my desk. And we talk superheroes for the whole session. And when they leave, they think they're superheroes. Yeah. I know. I know. So to be validated like that is wonderful. And again, if I can just change one life and make one child and family better off because I did this and my team did this, then it's worth it.
And one last time, what is the point of contact? If someone's listening and thinking, you know, I need to get involved. I want to get involved. I have something I can provide, and it could be in something thinking outside the box. Where do they go?
They can send us an email at putonthecape52@gmail.com, and our website is putonthecape.com. And you can see our events. You can donate to our foundation. It's all tax deductible. And it will get to an advocacy center and save a child.
I could talk to you hours and hours and hours.
We do that, don't we?
We do. Well, that ends it for that segment. So stay tuned for our next segment, the Stupid Suspect Stories.
More stories, inside guests, and true blue humor coming up on Badge Boys. We'll be back right after this.
I remember the moment. I'll never forget that moment.
As long as I live.
As long as I live.
Several of us were working to rescue a family.
The house collapsed on top of the cellar door and trapped them.
We had to use Humvees and heavy machinery to move massive trees and debris.
We got them out.
We helped a lot of people out.
It felt good to know I could really make a difference.
Because I'm a citizen soldier in the National Guard.
Be there the moment your community needs you. Learn more at NationalGuard.com.
Sponsored by the Arizona National Guard. Aired by the Arizona Broadcasters Association and this station.
Move over, AZ. Arizona's move over law requires you to move over or slow down when you drive past any vehicle pulled over with flashing lights. Remember, every vehicle, every time. Move over, AZ.
Sponsored by ADOT in partnership with the Arizona Broadcasters Association and this station.
You're listening to Badge Boys with retired police sergeant Darren Birch and retired police officer Jason Schechterly. Now, back to the Badge Boys.
Robin, we had some really interesting guests, did we not?
Oh, absolutely. And they even made me cry and laugh.
You know, I told you before the show, I said, without Jason, I don't know if I can make you cry. And it worked. You cried.
Yeah. Quite a few times, actually, I teared up. It wasn't like bawling tears, but it was bad enough.
Yeah, just listening to Sean's passion and dedication, having worked those crimes, child crimes, and seeing the horrible physical abuse, sexual abuse, and neglect, and all the things that go with it, just it breaks your heart. So if you can hold off from crying on that, then you're a better person than I am.
Well, I teared up. Like I said, I couldn't help it between the two of you.
And the one thing that Sean didn't talk about that I want to do now is this young officer, just such a great guy, a passion. He's been recognized by Jason Schechterly's own 100 Club honors. He's won awards. He's just an amazing person, and he won't even talk about that. He's talking about the kids because that's all that's important to him. And so I want to thank Jason Schechterly, who's not here, for his 100 Club giving this guy an award. Good stuff. And talking about good stuff, I think that's a good segue for our heroic headline.
Yay.
Yeah. This is from Phoenix. Baby showers are a very special occasion for expecting mothers, as we all know. It's a time to celebrate with family and friends and say thanks to all those who have been an important part of your life. And that sentiment rings true for one Arizona mom as she invited a very special guest to the baby shower. I don't get invites to baby showers as a guy. We just don't, right?
I do, but I can never go.
Most guys are listening saying, you know, I can't even tell you what goes on at a baby shower. But this Pinal County Sheriff Deputy, Dan Campbell, was invited to her baby shower. And why? Well, according to her Facebook post, her name is Cheyenne, and she was in and out of jails for years and until she was arrested on July 12, 2016. She was sentenced to 2 years in prison and had a child while she was incarcerated. Now out of prison, Cheyenne has turned her life around and is expecting her second child. And she said it's because of Dan Campbell. Quote, I can't tell you how many times he arrested me, Cheyenne said in this video. Quote, but I do want to thank him because if he hadn't, I would not be here right now and be pregnant. She added that this Pinal County deputy intervened in her life in such a way that she and her kids would be dead right now. The way he intervened, he saved their lives, she believes. They were all smiles as she opened presents at the shower in front of her guests and Dan Campbell, the one guy. She even took a moment to offer some advice to those fighting sobriety. She said those still struggling just need to really continue to work on sobriety. And, quote, if you want to get sober, you can get sober. So I want to give a shout-out to Cheyenne for recognizing Deputy Campbell for everything he did, arresting her, but because he cared about her, because he truly, genuinely wanted her to get better in this life of drugs and alcohol. It connected when she was in prison, and she invited him to her baby shower.
That just gives me chills up and down my body right
now. I'm with
now.
You.
I
got goosebumps.
Cool.
Isn't that beautiful? And as beautiful as that, I can turn it off just like a switch and go down to the bowels of humanity, the worst of the worst of people with our stupid suspect stories.
Shall we do it?
Let's do it.
Sorry, Jason.
This has to do with a fleeing burglary suspect who was struck and killed on I-10 west of Phoenix. I hate to, you know, make fun of the dead, but what he did was so stupid. Westbound Interstate 10 was reopened in Phoenix a couple weeks ago after it was closed. After a burglary suspect was struck and killed near 51st Avenue exit, the PIO, Sergeant Tommy Thompson, said that two men entered a Circle K store and stole, you ready for this?
Mm-hmm.
Lottery tickets. You're going to steal a lottery ticket, which is registered. As soon as you steal that lottery ticket, it's no longer valid. So they steal basically a useless item. It's not like they snuck it out of somebody's purse so that it still be good. No, they steal it from the store, so it's registered and it's no longer valid. The suspects then fled the scene in a vehicle that was taken from the parking lot, and they're in a chase, and the suspects get in a crash in the freeway. So now they're causing damage, injury to other people because stolen lottery ticket. And what does this one yahoo do? He runs into traffic and gets killed.
So does that mean that he bought his way into heaven? He won the lottery that way? I mean,
I think
oh,
it's a perfect Darwin lottery story. It's a Darwin lottery story, no doubt about it. Okay, going to our next stupid suspect.
Oh, no, another one.
Yeah, this one kind of hits home with me because of my sex crime background. Phoenix police say a 58-year-old resident at a state retirement facility for sex offender is accused of killing another resident over the victim's radio being too loud. 58-year-old Robert Wayne Fleming was arrested Tuesday on suspicion of second-degree murder. You see, the incident happened about 7:30 in the morning. This is in the morning when the 58-year-old Fleming and the 83-year-old Donald Faye Prather got into a fight in the hallway over Prather, the 83-year-old's radio being too loud. He's 83 years old.
Oh, my gosh.
And because the 58-year-old Robert Wayne Fleming had an issue with it, instead of just, you know, putting earmuffs on, telling the old man, and again, he's old, he's got to have the radio on probably because he has hard hearing
problems.
Yeah. They're both registered sex offenders living in this halfway house. Fleming struck the 83-year-old several times where the 83-year-old fell to the ground unconscious, his head striking the floor, and as a result, later died in a hospital. So this idiot 58-year-old sex offender ends up killing his 83-year-old sex offender roommate, basically. And now he's in prison where he obviously rightfully belongs. So that's a happy ending to a stupid suspect story as it relates to the 58-year-old. Hey, I'm sorry for that guy, but
I wonder what music they were playing.
It was probably Lawrence Welk.
Oh God.
Well, I don't know. Yeah. Maybe that's one of those mitigating circumstances. I don't know.
I don't know.
And then the last stupid suspect story I'm going to share, again from Arizona. We do have our share of stupid suspects here. I won't lie for the rest of the world listening. Tempe police report that on April 28th, about 5:30 in the morning, a woman heard banging on the door of her home. And this is in a East Valley area. When she opened the door, a man later identified as a 24-year-old Eric Paul Mannion, I kind of think of it as a minion, shoved his way into the home, knocking her over. The woman's dog barked and growled, scaring Mannion, forcing him to stay on the living room couch. That great dog cornered that idiot who knocked on the door and forced his way in. Of course, Mannion coming up with some lies, allegedly told police that he was trying to get away from people who were chasing him. Yeah, it's interesting how people are chasing you when you're committing a crime to a complete innocent victim. He also admitted to using meth and drinking beer. Yes, isn't it funny how when you're on meth and you're drinking beer and you're doing drugs, sometimes people chase you, imaginary people. I think it was all a lie anyways. I think it was horseshit, excuse my phrase. Police determined that his story of being chased was completely fictional. See, I knew it. And he was charged with assault and criminal trespassing. The reason I wanted to tell that suspect story, that stupid suspect story, is because it also paints a deeper need for education in our community. You do not have to open your door if someone's knocking. If you do not recognize that person at your door, and please certainly look out that door. If you don't recognize that person, do not open that door. Talk through the door, they'll hear you. And remember, you can call 911, and we'd rather go to a million false alarms than not go to one serious one. So please don't open that door if you're alone or even if you're not alone.
And, you know, I'll bring up a little piece of advice, too. I remember when I was married a few years ago, my ex-husband used to get mad at me for having the doors locked during the daytime. I said, look, I'm running our business through our home. You're gone all day. I'm by myself in a 2,700-square-foot house.
It.
I lock the doors because I've heard of home invasions happening where people just come up and shake the doorknob and, boom, they walk right in.
Yeah. People on drugs do it all day long.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So now that I threw us to the bowels of humanity, is there any way possible, Robin, in the absence of Jason, that you can bring our spirits up? Is it humanly possible?
Yeah, I'm going to kind of bring Jason right into this. And it was your guest Yvette that actually said this. Aww. She had a sentence that described her grandfather, and she said, in the worst of circumstances, he lived a great life. And, you know, Jason is always here to do the inspirational moment, and of course, with him being out of town doing his speaking gigs, I kind of went through his LinkedIn, and like he says, he likes to stalk my social media.
I love it. You're stalking him. Thank you.
Well, yeah, I'm returning
the favor.
Stalk.
Yeah.
So I went back to LinkedIn, and I found something he posted a month ago, and it kind of rephrases what Yvette said about her grandfather. So it's very short and sweet, but it's Jason. So give me a second. Let me pull
absolutely.
It up.
Oh, absolutely. And I'm so glad in his absence, he's still here. I love it.
Okay, so this is for you, Jason, in your words. It's not what you tell other people, nor what people tell you. The important words are the ones you whisper to yourself. I got this. Lord, grant me patience in my grief, patience in my struggle, and I got this. There's wonder and amazement on the other side of adversity. I've lost more than 50% of my eyesight, yet the sky is bluer than ever.
Aww.
I have no ears, yet the songs sound clearer.
Oh my gosh.
Laughter runs deeper, and my kids' voices are gifts renewed daily.
Now you can make me cry. That's beautiful.
I just got chills.
Knowing how much we love Jason, and you can just see him saying that, and his heart is just so huge. He's, Jason, we love you. We miss you, brother.
Yes,
and,
we do.
And can't wait for next week for your return. And until next week, stay safe.
Batch Boys. Thanks for listening to Batch Boys. Stories, insights, guests, and true blue humor with retired Police Sergeant Darren Birch and retired Police Officer Jason Schechterly. Batch Boys, heard weekly and worldwide on Star Worldwide Networks and all mobile devices. Batch Boys.